in some parts of Indonesia, entrepreneurship is actually very much in the blood of people, right? Like, it's not abnormal at all for people to start a business, right? It's like, in whether you're in an urban population, a rural population, right? People do what they need to do exactly to make ends meet.
Hi, I'm Diana Yao, your host on the Emerging Markets Tech Startups podcast. While traveling to over 90 countries, I was inspired by the entrepreneurial spirit across startup communities in Africa, Latin America, Asia, the Middle East, and Eastern Europe. On the show, we bring you stories from entrepreneurs, startup ecosystem innovators, and investors. We discuss what makes these markets culturally and historically unique, local trends, local challenges consumers and founders face, and the opportunities. Let's get started. So Nicole, it's so great to have you on our podcast. One, you're our first woman on this show, so I'm excited to have you. And two, you come from such a huge market that is the eyes of so many investors. So tell us a little bit about who you are, when you went back to Indonesia, and also what does Digiraya, the organization that you're a managing director for, do?
First of all, thanks so much for inviting me to be on this podcast. I mean, I really love that you're doing this to raise more awareness about, you know, what's going on in emerging markets. So my name is Nicole, as you mentioned. I'm currently sitting as the managing director for Digiraya. So we're a startup accelerator that focuses on working with early stage startups and helping them across multiple areas, including, you know, business model, growth, founder discussions, everything you can name. And so we've been working since about 2018, primarily in the Indonesian market, but now increasingly, and, you know, I think part of what the podcast is about is with more startups from outside of Indonesia as well, who have a really strong interest in bringing their business to the market and to the country. And so we totally recognize that it's a focal market for many investors and for many entrepreneurs as well. And so we want to be able to help bridge that gap and help them to be successful in Indonesia. I've been, you know, working in Indonesia since 2017, building this accelerator out, working with some really great people and some really amazing startups, and really excited to sharing more.
But when you went back and moved back there, what were things that surprised you about the local ecosystem, whether it's the startups or the people in the market?
So before I actually moved to Jakarta, I had actually been working in Silicon Valley. But honestly, you know, living in Silicon Valley, I felt a little bit jaded because I was just seeing so many startups emerging that I thought were just not really solving problems. They were, you know, carving out a little bit of a pie that was already full of money from tons of investors and just creating a very niche solution that may not go anywhere and may not add value anywhere outside of the Bay Area.
That was the exact disillusionment I experienced moving here. And still, 4 years later, I'm asking, do you need 10 startups that focus on dog sitting, picking up your laundry?
Right, exactly. Dog sitting, dog walking, valet parking, someone picking up your laundry. You know, these are all things that I was like, why do you need a startup to solve this problem for you? But on the other hand, you know, I saw what was going on in Indonesia as an emerging market. It was growing very quickly. And I could see that the startup ecosystem there was still very young. You know, as an emerging market, I think it's pretty fair to say that there's no shortage of big challenges that need to be solved. The dominant mindset of people, I would say, in Indonesia, it's changing now with kind of the emergent of more successful startups and the shifting mindset among young people to actually try their hand in entrepreneurship and actually build something. But the dominant mindset, I would say, is still fairly risk adverse. You know, a lot of people grow up hearing from their parents that what they need to do is get a stable job, work for the government. You know, we have so many unicorns and so many examples of really successful startups in Indonesia. And I, like I said, the mindset is shifting as people see more examples of what's possible.
But I almost wonder, that's most of the population in the world, right? Even in the US, it is this unique culture of entrepreneurship based in New York and San Francisco. But if you go to Middle America, they might be teaching them some of the same things.
In some parts of Indonesia, entrepreneurship is actually very much in the blood of people, right? Like, it's not abnormal at all for people to start a business, right? It's like, in whether you're in an urban population, a rural population, right? People do what they need to do exactly to make ends meet. If you ask a lot of people, even like the older generation, they would say that starting a business was something they've already done or they know somebody who has.
And that's why emerging markets is so fascinating to me, because entrepreneurship is institutionalized into society, because that was the only option to survive back then. For example, my parents grew up in communist China, and if they had just depended on the government's ration, they would have not have been able to survive. So instead, early on, they learned how to hustle. They couldn't depend on finding a job, so they had to create their own jobs. And when demand for that thing they were selling grew really big, they started hiring other people. And naturally, that led to creating a business. Question, why do you think investors should care more about Indonesia than other markets?
You know, like you said, I think nowadays there's more and more attention being turned to Indonesia as a market, as a country, because of how many people live there, right? 260, 270 million people. That makes it the fourth largest, China, India, and the US, right? And so that's not a small country. Some of the things that really strike me as unique about Indonesia, one is its diversity, like I mentioned. It's the largest archipelago nation in the world. So 17,000 islands stretching from east to west, right? You have Sumatra all the way in the west, all the way to like East Nusa Tenggara in the east. And so many different cultures and religions. And you have like Hinduism in Bali, but then you have Islam in Java, right? So it's such a multicultural country, and to see the juxtaposition of how all of these people are able to live together is really interesting. The other great thing is that it's a very young population. So we have a population of 270 million people. 50% of those people are under the age of 30. And so a lot of people have been talking about how in the next decade, Indonesia is going to have what they call a demographic bonus, right? So that means that the working population of all of this kind of 50% of the population will be moving into the working and productive population of the country. They also see that GDP is going up. So, you know, we're at that tipping point. I think it's something like $4,000 per capita is kind of the tipping point where it gets from like being a kind of emerging to emerged market where people start having disposable income, are able to make discretionary purchases. And so Indonesia is getting to that point. Mobile penetration is also really good. I've heard a stat that says that the average Indonesian has like 1.5 phones. So it's very normal for people to have more than one phone on them. So they're hyper-connected, at least in the kind of developed areas of the country. And so they're becoming a tech first, young, increasingly wealthy, and huge population, right? And so for, you know, investors, startups, business in general, right? Like that looks really good. And so I think it's no surprise that we're getting more and more inquiries and more questions about what the opportunities are in Indonesia.
Indonesians are some of the most connected people. Apparently on average, Indonesians on social media have thousands of friends because it's just in the culture to befriend people, to add people who you've never even met. I think it stems from it being a more trusting society. Can you speak a little bit about this?
So people love to be social. They love to connect with each other. They love to chat with each other. I don't think I've ever had as many WhatsApp groups as I've ever had before moving to Indonesia. I've learned that this is actually not a culture that is common in other countries, but in Indonesia, you'll have a WhatsApp group for your work, you'll have a WhatsApp group for your family, you'll have one for your friends, and then you'll have like subgroups. You'll have like just the young people in your family, you'll have just the teams in your company. So interesting to see how much Indonesians love to just be connected with each other all the time. So I think social media has been huge in Indonesia. I know like Instagram right now, for example, is, I mean, everybody has at least, yeah, everyone has at least one Instagram account, if not more than one. They're super active. I think I have more followers and follow more people from Indonesia than I do
the rest of the world,
any other country, yeah, in the world. All my Instagram stories are from like Indonesia. People start businesses on Instagram. they use Instagram and WhatsApp, and like that's enough for them to run a business, you know? So because of this kind of high technology penetration and also high social media penetration in Indonesia, it becomes very easy to start a business using social media channels. And so direct to consumer is extremely popular. And I would say is...
And what are they selling? Is it like selling food or actually, you know, retail product?
Everything and anything. So we've done accelerators that are just focused on food merchants, for example. A lot of them sell their products on Instagram. We've done direct-to-consumer batches. They're doing cosmetics. They're doing food products. They're doing fashion. Basically anything can be sold on Instagram. And so basically you'll go online, you'll find a profile and it's got some products that you're interested in. And so they'll have the contact information of that person or that vendor in their bio. And it's usually like their WhatsApp or their Line account. And you'll just interact with them as if they're a person. Like you'll tell them, I'm interested in this product. And they'll ask you, okay, well, what size do you want? And you'll tell them, and they'll ask you, what color do you want? And you'll tell them, and they'll collect your shipping information and everything. And they'll tell you to pay them into a bank account, which doesn't have like, which is really interesting, right? Like for me, this is pretty shocking when I got to Indonesia, because they would just see like, send me $50 to this bank account. And it's a nondescript bank account. It's just a number. And it's attached to a person's name. It's not attached to a business. It's attached to a name, right? And so I'm like, am I really going to send Mary $50? Like I've never met her. I don't know her. Could this be fraud? But it's not, like it's very normal. And so every time I've done this online, it has never been an issue.
Wow, that's trust right there. Having a trusting society has a huge impact on internet adoption and internet activity. I remember I was doing research in emerging markets. For example, in Mexico, a good chunk of people learn to fear the internet before they experience benefits. And it seems like in Indonesia, maybe that's less of a problem, and hence more people are coming online and participating in transactions and commerce naturally, and this alone can contribute to explosive growth because it doesn't dilute demand. Whereas in other markets, there's already a mental barrier, and that has actually limited demand. And we see this in certain demographics across the world. When we talk about those that are not on the internet, the older population make up a good chunk of that population. And it's not because they don't have the income. If you think about it, older population probably has more income to spare. Instead, it's the mental limitations that cap demand. I'm also curious, how has online commerce proliferated if there's a huge unbanked population?
A lot of that is actually coming from startups in the fintech space. So I think fintech was probably one of the first or earliest spaces to see a tremendous growth in Indonesia. E-wallets, for example, have, like, I could talk to you for hours about the e-wallet war.
Who are the dominant players?
So right now, the biggest two are Gojek. So they have GoPay. And there's also OVO, which is part of the Grab ecosystem. These two, I mean, I don't even know how much of the market they dominate, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's like 80% at least between the two of them.
And how do they work?
Basically, the only thing you need to do to have a GoPay or an OVO account is a phone and a phone number. There's many ways that you can actually load money into the account. For example, convenience stores. So we have Alpha Mart, we have Indomaret, which are two really big convenience store chains. So you can go there, you can show this your account number to the cashier, and they'll put money into the account for you. So if you're ordering a ride, so kind of Gojek's like first service that they ever offered was on-demand motorcycle transportation, Ojeks. So Ojek drivers, you call one and you're riding with them, you also have the option to give them cash and they'll put it directly into your e-wallet account as well.
That's a whole nother level of convenience. It's crazy to see emerging markets go from the M-Pesa model, which in itself was already innovative. What made M-Pesa innovative when it started? Instead of ATM machines and banks on every corner,
and they offer incentives,
like
right,
we have to in get developed markets,
put money
they built off
e-wallet.
The existing infrastructure, which was these small mom and pop shops on the corners who subsisted on selling top-ups or candy. They were turned into local ATMs who helped to withdraw and deposit cash into your mobile wallet. Now this Gojek model seems like next level. Instead of needing to go to a physical store, you just stop one of these Ojek drivers who, when I visited Indonesia, they were literally everywhere. They were more common
to find than cars on the street. And they were also easily detectable because they would wear a green helmet, a green vest.
And it seems like a big part of it is these companies have made it so easy to do it. So just that availability to access cash and to top up, they've made it so easy that...
Are the OJECs, the motorcycle drivers, incentivized to help people top up?
Company will actually give you incentives to say that if you can get 10 people to top up more than $5, for example, there's a small share in that for them as well. So they're definitely doing as much as they can to encourage more people to be onboarded and become users of their e-wallets. And I would say so far it's been really successful. I mean, I probably use my e-wallets in Indonesia more than I use money and more than I use cards. Like it's just become, oh, and you can transfer money between peers as well. Like you can send money to people. So if you buy something and you just split it with your friends, they can pay you in GoPay. They don't need to pay you in cash. And that makes it a much easier transaction as well. So, you know, when you have an idea of what's possible, right? M-Pesa is like possible. And a lot of people recognize that and are like, wow, this is such a great example of innovation and supporting the unbanked population, right? Then it becomes more and more possible to build on top of existing ideas and to improve on them. And I think in Indonesia, people, the founders of Gojek, they realize that there's a strong habit that people in Indonesia already have and need that they already have, right? And so they're just building this process or this service of an e-wallet into something that people already do on an everyday basis, right? They're taking these OJECs to work, to and from work every day. So it's a very natural thing, like a low barrier thing.
And that is strong product thinking. Like when we build products, we always say, we need to align with how users' behaviors are today. It's so hard to change their behavior, but if you can align and make it so easy for them, and I don't want this whole episode to be about Gojek, but I am just so impressed with how they built a super app. So can you talk about like maybe some of the other services they were able to build after they built that Gojek infrastructure?
So I just looked at my phone, for example, and I had Gojek, and then right next to it, I had Go Life. And Go Life is like their home services stuff. Like you can order a doctor, you can order
a doctor to come to you.
Oh, I think so. You can order a massage, you can order a makeup artist, you can order a house cleaner, all on demand. And I think they've spun all of that out into Go Life. There's a whole like marketplace for things that you can actually buy products from. You can send someone to go to a store to buy things for you. Go Play. So Go Play is their kind of like content arm. And so they're actually producing original content on GoPlay. Right. And so that's another way to keep people coming back to the app. And it's also because they recognize that like media consumption, online media consumption in Indonesia is huge. And is a huge way to penetrate the markets. The most succinct way to explain Gojek is that they're a super app.
And that's another thing that has really fascinated me about emerging market tech startups. A lot of them have copied the Chinese model, such as WeChat, Meituan, and being a super app. In the US, the tech companies didn't necessarily gravitate towards there, except the likes of Amazon. And then you began to see a trend of companies like Uber, who started adding other services like food delivery. And it made so much sense because you're using your existing infrastructure to extend those value-added services, which is valuable to the user and the business. I mean, who wants to use 10 apps for 10 different services? When they can all vertically be integrated into one, you can use that one set of data that I've provided them to provide me other services, which means people are spending more time and money in that one app itself. And that further increases that company's moat, making it harder and harder to compete with them.
You can literally be in their app for a whole day and get everything that you need and use GoPay to pay for it. And sorry, I know we're not trying not to talk just about Gojek. Just such a fascinating thing to think about because of like how much they've been able to change the ecosystem in Indonesia, really. Like they were the first unicorn, now decacorn of Indonesia, right? They really set the stage for just like what startups can actually achieve. One of the things that I thought was really interesting that Gojek did that really changed the way people interact with their wallet is when they started integrating GoPay into offline payments as well. So, and this was around, like, this was within my kind of like lifetime in Indonesia. I think it was 2018 when this started and, you know, OVO and GoPay kind of started doing this around the same time where offline merchants could also accept payments from GoPay by scanning a barcode or like entering a phone number or whatever. Right. So WeChat model, that that scaled so fast. Like, I can't, you know, one day you see a barcode outside like one restaurant in a strip mall, and then you come back a week later and they all have them.
I'm curious, is privacy a concern amongst consumers in Indonesia? Because it doesn't feel like it. You were telling me the story before. People usually have a high sense of trust in paying people or businesses on Instagram. I imagine people are not very shy about sharing their personal data.
So it's interesting. I've had this question asked to me before of, you know, because I know like in the US, for example, and in the Europe, obviously, right, there's a lot of discussion around privacy, protection of information and everything, and making sure that tech companies are either not able to access it or are using it responsibly. In Indonesia, and people ask me, is that happening in Indonesia as well? Do people have these concerns about their privacy? And to be honest, I don't think so.
Take my data, give me better services.
They're exactly like they are. There's a willingness to overlook that, I think, for the sake of convenience almost, is too high to give up. And there's also a social aspect to it as well, right? Like I mentioned earlier that Indonesia, it's a very high context culture. It's a very social culture. There's very much a feeling of like fitting in and going along with everybody. And so I think when there's a dominant mindset of like, hey, this is really cool, we're all going to do it, and not ask questions about it, that it tends to kind of just like become the brain, like the groupthink.
Do you think that steeps from the culture? I mean, part of it is Asian culture, collectivism is a big thing that kind of dominates.
Yeah, I mean, I think for Indonesians, like it's definitely in the culture. So, like this is also why I think like coffee shops have been so successful, like in Jakarta at least, right? And now it's like spreading more and more. Like you see Kopi Kenangan as one of the emerging startups that has kind of started as just a really simple coffee shop, but they've grown so much. And the reason why I think also that they've been really successful is, again, because Indonesians love to go out. They love to have coffee, right? They just want to go and have coffee and hang out with their friends. And they're looking for a cheap, affordable place to let them do that. And so for a startup like Kopi Kenangan, they're charging like $1 for an iced coffee. That makes it really accessible. And so that's something that people will easily do. You know, Indonesians are just looking for something to like help them be more connected and help them to be more social.
Summarize this portion of market understand. Indonesians are obsessed with socializing. They don't care that much about privacy. Not yet.
Exactly. I definitely think that's part of it, right? They haven't seen the consequences of it yet. There's been no big scandals or anything that have happened that have really opened their eyes to it. And so for them, they're like, well, nothing's happened. So why do I need to worry about it?
Right. What's the worst that could happen? We've talked so much about Gojek, but there's all these other brilliant companies. Just name a couple that comes to mind, whether it's from the unicorns to...
So Indonesia has 6 unicorns, which for the region, I think is either the same as or better than Singapore for the number one spot. And so, and these startups, so Gojek is obviously one of them. There's Traveloka, which is like a travel OTA kind of service. There's Tokopedia, which is a e-commerce service. There's several others that are kind of in a similar vein. But the interesting thing about unicorns in Indonesia is that they've been able to achieve unicorn status without ever leaving their home market. Right. And so that's, you know, for other large markets, I think that's unsurprising. But for Southeast Asia and for most other countries in the world, the idea that you can become a unicorn without ever exiting your own market is pretty compelling. And so the fact that there's already 6, I think is a great sign. Like Gojek became the first unicorn in 2016. And so, you know, we've been adding unicorns every year since then. And I think that trend is most likely going to continue. In terms of kind of what other interesting startups there are out there, for me, the ones that are really interesting are the ones now that are growing because they're solving other significant challenges that Indonesians face, which to me are access to healthcare and access to education. Take a look at HelloDoc. So HelloDoc is a really great startup from Indonesia. They're the biggest health tech player right now. So they do telemedicine, but you can also order medicine from them. You can do consultations with. So they're providing basically like the whole kind of healthcare ecosystem, digital healthcare ecosystem, enable access to healthcare to, you know, a whole kind of previously unreachable population of Indonesians. And then on top of that, there are startups that are kind of in the healthcare space as well, but
filling in more niche spaces, I would say. So one that I really love, who's actually an alumni of our program, is a startup called Reliv, R-I-L-I-V. So they're relatively young. I think they're now raising their Series A, if I'm not wrong. But what I really love about them is that they're looking at the mental health space, which is, you know, especially for founders, right, is something that a lot of people struggle with. But in Indonesia, it still, you know, has that stigma attached to it of not being able to kind of openly talk about your mental health and being able to seek the help that you need. And also the fact that there are just such a shortage of trained psychologists available across the country. And so through their platform, they've created a safe space where people can connect with psychologists, can talk about what they're going through, can seek the healthcare that they need, and can do it in a way that, you know, doesn't have them associated with that stigma that unfortunately I think still exists in a lot of the country. But they've caught a lot of attention recently.
The second one is education. So there's a couple of players in the education space that are doing really well. The two that I really like that are probably considered competitors right now are Ruang Guru and Xenius. So these are two online education startups who are working with teachers, developing online content, again, to help students who maybe are struggling with school or are living in areas where access to education is a challenge, you know, especially now with COVID, a lot of education is happening online. And so for these startups, Xenius, Ruang Guru, and HelloDoc, it's actually a really great time for them, right? People are looking for these types of solutions. They're both doing really well. So like direct to consumer area is growing like crazy as well.
And so another really kind of compelling and growing sector in Indonesia is this like SME, like micro enterprise space, right? How do we take all these like typically offline merchants, of which there are thousands and thousands and thousands across the country, who are like, you know, own restaurants or own like little stalls on the side of the road, or you know, these types of businesses that are typically offline, like how can we bring them online? How can we help them get connected? How can we help them manage their business, become more efficient, you know, connect them into the supply chain more effectively. So there are several startups that are doing some really interesting work.
I think you brought up last week that Indonesia or the startups there are another one of those few countries that can just think about their market solely and still find wild success. The only other markets like that are China or the US. I mean, even within Europe is not the case, right? And even for markets that are 90 million people, for example, in Egypt, they still have to think about across the Middle East. When I was in Iran, same thing. Turkey, same thing. But I think once you hit the 200 million mark, because even in Nigeria, they also are able to focus on their own region, but still needing to expand a bit to Ghana. Indonesia is really unique in that sense.
Yeah. I think that's an interesting point that you made, you know, like what is kind of the tipping point at which the value proposition of like building a startup that solves a very local problem is a more compelling business case than building a service that can expand. Yeah. It can be generalized to other markets. Like, I wonder, you know, whether there's a pattern.
But nonetheless, it's not easier because you still have, what, almost 300 million people in the country. You said, what was it, 7 million islands, whatever.
not that many, but 17,000. So yeah, not too far off. Almost 7 million.
Still a ton of people. Kind of disparate types of geographies, and you mentioned different cultures as well.
It is a very diverse country in and of its own right, and so I think that, you know, even if like they're saying, okay, let's just focus on Indonesia as a market, even saying that is going to come with its own complexities, right? Like it's definitely not a homogeneous market, so you do have to think.
Right, you mentioned travel, locas, experiences vary, probably. I don't know, minimalistic, because you said it's very focused, whereas Gojek on the other side, there's just a ton of things. And I was thinking whether there's best practice design principles for certain populations, Because in the US, maybe booking.com is what excites us, because us as a very consumer-driven culture, we love choices. We love 1,000 options thrown at us. But I wonder if there's certain principles you've noticed from working with startups.
The startups in Indonesia, as they grow, it seems like are leaning more towards like the WeChat model, which is like one app to rule them all, basically, right? So instead of saying like, we're just gonna have the Gojek app for like ordering rides, and then the GoFood app for ordering food, and then the like GoSend app for sending packages. There's one app, Gojek, and in Gojek, you have access to all of these services, right? And so you as a user can spend your entire day, I think I mentioned this before, in one app and achieve like everything that you need. I heard someone say really interestingly that, you know, the real estate play there's a higher real estate play for the app, like in-app services, than there is for you to get a new person to download a new app onto their phone. Like it's more compelling for you to have an additional service added in the Gojek app than it is to create a new app that someone then has to download onto their phone, because the likelihood of the person using that service, if they're in the Gojek app, is much higher than getting them to download a separate app for a separate service.
And I mean, hearing so much about the Indonesian VC, it is so unique. When I went to visit, one, the number of VCs that exist, and two, just how much funding they're getting. So can you talk a bit about sort of the insights you've drawn from the VC ecosystem? Like, what are they looking for? Just disambiguate that for us.
So that, I think, is a relatively recent trend. I would say, like, when I first moved to Indonesia, I don't think there were as many VCs present in the market yet as there are now. And like, I totally agree with you, just the number of VCs, local VCs that exist in Indonesia looking for investment opportunities in Indonesia is really interesting. There's a couple of unique kind of characteristics, I guess, about VCs in Indonesia that I've noticed. One is they tend to be focused on earlier stage companies. So that's actually our sweet spot, but looking at these like either seed all the way to kind of pre-series A to series A round is usually where they're focusing their efforts. They do have pretty, like, they have funding for sure. Like, there's obviously a number of VCs in Indonesia that have been able to raise funds to invest. But I haven't seen like that reflected in their ticket sizes. Because their ticket sizes, interestingly, are still pretty small. Like I said, like they're still focusing on these early stage investment opportunities. And so it could be, for example, like that the VCs are taking a more like diversified approach, where they're more compelled to write smaller ticket sizes for more investments rather than try to put, you know, a lot of money into a single investment, right? And so on the flip side of that, when you start getting into the later stages, and like it's changing now, I do know a few VCs that are starting to move into like the Series B stage, although I'd say there's still not that many. When it comes to getting later rounds, startups usually have to start looking to VCs from like Singapore or from the US or from other markets to help them to raise that round. Why are there so many VCs in Indonesia? I mean, one is, it's just a huge market to begin with. But two is like, there is a huge accumulation of wealth in Indonesia, right? Like you do have a pretty sizable population of the country that is doing really, really, really well, right? Like they've been—
Where's the money coming from?
yeah, I mean, you know, obviously like tobacco is big, like palm oil is big. And like, we can talk about whether that's good or bad, but you know, family businesses that have been around for a while and have grown, like in real estate and banking, you know, there are a lot of really wealthy people in Indonesia. Like that, I think, is no surprise. And so they are looking for ways to be more active in the investment space, and like especially kind of the second generation, right? So these are like not the kind of first generation who are now like grandparents who worked really hard to build a business, but the ones who they've kind of passed it on to, who are now a little bit more in touch with what's going on in the startup space and are looking for more ways to get involved and want to be part of this kind of startup scene, but don't really know how to do that. That's where the VCs come in and can say like, hey, why don't you work with us? We'll help you invest your money and make some pretty interesting bets.
So even there, it's coming from quote unquote old money or other industries. Because in other markets, we're even hearing, they're asking themselves, why would I invest in tech when I get more surety investing in real estate and traditional industries?
Investors don't yet understand the risk associated with like putting your money in a VC, right? Like they are excited about the idea of investing in a startup because, again, they see the really successful ones and think, I want to be a part of that because they're making like 100x return. Like, that's amazing. But they don't realize like the downside.
Right. That only 5% make it.
Right, exactly. Like that really successful startup is not the startup that you're going to get when you invest with a VC. But I do think that VCs in Indonesia are, you know, going to be under a lot of pressure, honestly. Because there's a lot of excitement and enthusiasm and like I would almost say hype on like kind of investing in startups. Like it's become a thing to be like, I want to invest in startups, but people may not recognize what that actually means from a financial returns perspective. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see kind of how like the first funds and the second funds of these VCs actually turn out and whether they can find ways to, you know, raise their third or fourth fund.
I think China's going through something similar, has where people from all different wealth generated from different industries are pouring money and competing against each other to invest in startups. And it is this bubble, but I think if anything, this is better than the alternative because in most emerging markets, all the other episodes that I've recorded, people say capital is one of the largest things where there's not enough of in that ecosystem. And when you don't have that foundational capital, it's so hard to even get to something, to build something like Gojek in the first place. You're just stuck at this global minimum.
Right. I guess it sounds like Indonesia is quite unique in that way where capital isn't the issue. I would say it's more like sourcing quality investments, which is actually the challenge. So it's almost a reversal, I guess, of the situation that you seem to be seeing in other emerging markets. So that's really interesting. It's really interesting to hear.
The VC landscape is so interesting. What are some names, just so our audience who's interested in doing some research off the top of your head, and you mentioned the ticket sizes are small, but when I heard what you mentioned last week, I was like...
So I guess I should say small in the sense of like, the series that they're investing in, right? Like the rounds that they're investing in and that they're not looking at like a series B, series C, that they're looking at like a pre-series A to a series A and like...
They're small relative to Silicon Valley, you were saying.
Maybe, yeah, exactly. But maybe not small relative to like other emerging markets.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What were some of the numbers?
It's really interesting. I think, I don't know, like maybe I've talked about this last time as well, but ticket sizes themselves have changed. Like even in like the 2 or 3 years that I've been around, right? Like nowadays a series A can be like a $5 to $10 million valuation. I think I've seen as high as $15 million valuation for a series A and like the startup raising like a $3 to $5 million round for a series A, which I think like a few years ago you would have expected like a $5 million valuation for a series A round. And ticket sizes like $1 million or fundraising rounds of like $1 million. So it's already grown quite a bit just in like the last few years. Some people say it's a bit of a bubble. You'd probably be in a better place to say than I would, you know, just kind of like in comparison to other like ecosystems and the investment trends that you've seen. Whether that's true or not, but
it all depends if it pops. If it never does, then it's a great bubble.
Yeah, it's great for the ecosystem. No, I mean, I think the Indonesian ecosystem definitely has a significant advantage being as big as it is and being, you know, as attractive to foreign investors as it is. I definitely think there's no shortage of opportunity. I think the question will come is whether the Indonesian startups and the Indonesian founders can actually like capitalize on that and really like convert that into real
value. Yep.
Yeah. That to me is going to be the question. You're asking about like, what are some, I guess, like names of VCs that are pretty active in Indonesia?
What are the Sequoias and Andreessen Horowitz of Indonesia?
East Ventures is one that people know really well. They're probably one of the largest in terms of like number of investments that they've made. We did work really closely with Kinesis Group, Intuito Ventures, Gobi Ventures, Golden Gate, AC Ventures, Convergence, Open Space. I think I'm just like listing off VCs at this point.
And these are all...
Golden Gate is not. Gobi is, but they invest. I think they're from China, but they invest in Indonesia and in China. But the other ones that I mentioned are all like Indonesian funds.
I'm so curious. Well, I don't know that much about the Singaporean ecosystem, but do you feel like the Indonesian startup ecosystem is even stronger than the Singaporean one?
In terms of like dollars invested, I think Singapore still comes out ahead. And that's because a lot of investors feel safer investing in Singapore, in an entity in Singapore, right? Like it's just because of, you know, like all the, I guess, financial securities and the structures and safeties that exist to make sure that like financial transactions are handled responsibly. However, Indonesian startups recognize this 100%. And so a lot of them have, I think, it's very common knowledge that an Indonesian startup will have an entity in Singapore, and that will be the entity that they fundraise with. And so, you know, even though a lot of that money on paper, it looks like it's going into Singapore companies, in reality, it's going into companies that have an entity in Singapore.
Maybe that's what's happening in the US too, because a lot of these startups in other countries are creating Delaware C shell companies in the US so that US investors would be willing and feel safer due to the regulatory familiarity to invest in them. So that's such a good point. Wow, I'm totally blown away and I'm dying to go visit again once kind of COVID closes down. And I know you're waiting to go back to be in the center of the excitement. So a ton of the audience probably listening to this and they're like, I want to be a part of this. What are 1 to 2 to 3 ways that they can help?
I think if anyone's really excited about Indonesia and wants to learn more, then 100%, like, of course, we want to hear from you. I think whether you're a startup from outside of Indonesia that wants to expand into Indonesia as your next market, or you're an investor from outside of Indonesia that wants to get involved and try to find good investment opportunities in Indonesia, like that's something that we definitely have done and want to help more people to do, because it's just good for the ecosystem when there's more of this like international connectivity. So for anyone who's interested, like you can go to our website, Digitaraya.
Even you struggle saying it.
Digitaraya. Well, I try to say it so that you can kind of hear how it's spelled. Like Digitaraya. Yeah, because in Indonesia, like we'd say Digitaraya.
There you go.
I recognize that to listeners, that may be a little bit hard to pick up. You can always email me directly as well. So my email is pretty easy. It's nicole@digitaraya.com. So feel free to email me anytime. Connect with me on LinkedIn for sure. I love chatting with people about what's going on in Indonesia and finding more people that are excited about working together to build the ecosystem there. And I mean, the other thing is just, you know, do your research, like try to learn more about what's going on in Indonesia and talk to people in your own network about Indonesia as well, right? Like, I think the thing that really is going to put Indonesia on the map is just having that international awareness and having more people talk about what's happening and sharing the stories and the excitement and the stats, and building that awareness and that case for more like investors, for example, to be putting their money into startups in Indonesia. Like that's how we're going to really start shifting the conversation. And it's happening already, right? Like I think, for example, Kopi Kenangan, which like we didn't even talk about, but they're a coffee chain startup that recently raised funds from Sequoia and all, of course, but they recently raised funds from Jay-Z's VC. I forget what it's called. But
so random. How did they get the Jay-Z?
That's the thing, right? I forget. I talked to Ed a while ago, the founder, about how that happened, and he explained it to me, but I was just so puzzled at how this all happened. But that kind of thing puts Indonesia on the map. That's what gets people thinking, oh, why would somebody like Jay-Z be looking at Indonesia, right? And it forces people to ask that question and start digging and start uncovering the opportunities. So that's the kind of thing I want to see more of. Do a little bit of reading, go to TechCrunch and look up Indonesia and read about what's going on. Go to Tech in Asia and read about what's going on. Go to KR Asia, go to Nikkei Review. There's so many ways you can learn more about what's happening in Indonesia that I think just that bit of research would really open a lot of people's eyes and get them excited about the opportunities here as well.
And that's why we're so thankful to have you on this episode to educate the listeners who are interested in emerging markets. Indonesia's lucky to be in the hot sort of hype now, and people know it. It's a big population. People love Bali, so that might be another reason. Maybe that's how Jay-Z found out.
Yeah. We could do a whole episode probably just on Bali if that's what it would take to get people to come here.
Well, thank you so much for your time. This has been no short of brilliant, and I'm so excited for everyone to be reaching out to you.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed chatting with you.
Thanks for joining us today on the Emerging Markets Tech Startup Show. If you have questions, comments, requests for me to cover an emerging market, or want to be connected with today's guests, leave me a comment in the reviews or find me on Twitter @DianaYao. Until next time.